Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
We'd all love to hit skip on our problems now and again, but using weed to deal with stress as a teen won't make your issues go away. Learn more at mindovermarijuana.com. That's mindovermarijuana.com.
Sponsored by the California Department of Public Health.
My name is Travis Bean.
My name is Chris Lambert.
And welcome to Film Colossus,
your guide to movies.
You, the one with that smile.
Oh, I love, this is a lovely feeling. I love the diary episodes where we just talk about the movies we watch. This is where I feel comfortable.
Yeah, we just get to dive into a ton of movies and give a lot of intense thoughts, sometimes funny, sometimes charming, sometimes infuriating.
Mostly that last word you said.
What, people don't respect people having other opinions?
Not in my experience anyway. Maybe you would have a probably easier time with that. Me, no, it's constantly contentious.
Yeah, nah, the movies that I feel like intense about in a negative way tend to make a lot of people mad.
I have a feeling we both watched a movie these past 2 weeks that a lot of people love that you and I both didn't really care for. You don't even know which movie I'm talking about.
Wait, maybe I do. Okay.
Maybe you do.
Okay. Okay.
We'll get to that.
Okay, so we're going to go through the movies that we watched the last couple weeks. I have 6 of them. How many do you have?
Okay, technically full movies, I have 11. But there's one movie I've watched most of because my wife and I were watching it last night. That I've seen before, so like I know how it ends and everything. So okay. I've kind of watched 12 movies.
Okay, you had me going there in the first half. It's just like, well, how are you going to include that one? But you've seen it before. Okay, well, What was the best of the lot?
Well, I'm not going to talk about Knock at the Cabin because we talked about that one ad nauseum already. That was my number one movie over the past 2 weeks. But other than that, my number one movie was, and I know this is really going to be hard for you to believe, Chris, Magic Mike's Last Dance.
No. Come on. What?
Soderbergh, baby. I love me some Soderbergh.
You really do.
Man, I just, like, stepping outside of this movie for, well, I guess it what I'm about to say does include this movie's aesthetic and everything, but I really love the energy captured by Soderbergh in his movies. There's this, there's almost like a relaxedness to his movies where we're kind of just fumbling along with characters as they get stuck in these bizarre situations. Like, his movies to me are almost cartoonish in that sense, where like the people we're following are just like, they're normal, but then they get roped into something like really bizarre and insane. And we're watching them go through the motions of something so spectacular, yet it's presented in a very like matter of fact way. I just find that like that whole approach so intoxicating and indigestible and easy to watch. Like, and he always has such good actors in his movies. Like, the formula just works really well. So even when his movies like aren't as good, like I didn't like No Sudden Moves that much, like still like it's very watchable and like all the people in the movie are doing good work. So I'm always way on board for a Soderbergh movie.
How do you feel about Haywire?
I actually haven't seen Haywire. I've always been interested, though.
I remember seeing that one in theaters and being like, what the hell am I watching? Like, what?
That's Well, the woman in Haywire, is it like Gina Carano? What? God, I'm like
Carano.
Carano, yeah. Like she's not really an actor. Was that part of what made it bizarre?
A little bit. It was more like the use of music. There were times where like the musical choice to like a chase scene or something. I remember distinctly at one point looking around the theater wanting to make eye contact with somebody who is also just like, yeah, I don't know what's going on either.
What if I was in that movie theater and we made eye contact and you didn't even realize it?
That would have been impressive.
But yeah, I love that. Just going into a movie, I know I'm going to get that. So like I'm on board. But this movie in particular, I'm a big fan of this franchise. I really, really like the first movie, but the second movie, Magic Mike XXL, it has been well documented at this point. It's one of my absolute favorite movies, like a top 10 movie for me. One thing I really love about this franchise is its ability to capture just like the joy of life. It's, you know, Chris, you've heard me complain about this so many times. Like, I'm so, so sick of movies just being like so grim and dour. Like, every movie is just about like the pains of life and everything wrong with the world. Like, and that's okay to do, I think, in a movie. Like, inherently, that explores all these facets of life. And it's a beautiful use of the medium. But I think as a result, a lot of movies end up just being really cynical. In a way that's like not very interesting to me and kind of ignoring all of like the nice parts of life. And then on the other end, like when a movie does it a little bit too much and is a little overly sentimental, it's annoying and feels just like not actually reflective of reality. That's why I love the Magic Mike movies, because they find an amazing balance and they're overtly optimistic movies. Like they're movies about people overcoming very simple problems. Like people who aren't facing like a nadir in life or anything, they aren't confronted by something overwhelming and unbelievable. They're just stuck in these very real situations and they need a little help to make a pivot in their life to just reorient themselves a little bit. And each of these movies has done that, especially Magic Mike XXL. Like the community of all of these, as they call themselves, male entertainers coming together and finding the beautiful art of like self-expression through dance and using it to like find their voice and find their place in the world and like make that pivot that they need to put themselves on a better path. Like, it's just incredible how these movies do that. And Magic Mike's Last Dance just continues that. It's we meet up with Mike again, like his business ventures have failed and he's like at this moment in life where he needs that pivot. And he comes across Selma Hayek, who is also in the exact same state. Like, she has a miserable marriage. She wants to move on from it. She wants something new and something to invigorate her. And they both give that to each other. And they do it through putting together the show. So, like, the movie just becomes a giant exploration of that as they put together the show. And then ultimately the show at the end, just like all the other movies, becomes this beautiful, energetic display of, like, what they've accomplished and the catharsis they've reached together.
Did it make you cry?
It made me cry so many times, Chris. Like, I, it's embarrassing. I'm just going to admit like, embarrassing shit in this episode because I love Magic Mike movies so much. But there was a moment in Magic Mike's Last Dance where they're putting on a show at the end. And gosh, should I go into this? I feel like I'm going down a big rabbit hole here.
I don't know. You're the only one that can tell us. Go for it.
So there's a scene earlier in the movie where Mike is putting together this show where these guys who are just more of traditional dancers are now learning how to be strippers. And so they're putting on this show where they're going to bring women on stage and they're going to do a lap dance. And so this one guy is trying out how you do a lap dance with somebody. And he gets on the woman, you know, he rubs his face in her breast. He's like all over her, like jumping around. And Mike was like, hey, man, that was really good. He's like, but you have to get in there a little more. Like, you need to play with the idea of like permission and like this woman's permitting you to be on her and like to give her pleasure and everything. So he shows this guy how to do it. And I got to say, it's just incredible. Like, say what you want about like a movie that's about dudes, giving women lap dances, but like watching Channing Tatum do what he does, it's like, it's pure, it's pure art. Like, this dude is just so good at it. It's like amazing to watch. And then, so he shows him how to do it, and everybody in the crowd is like, oh shit, yeah, like that's how you do it. So later in the movie, when it's finally time for this dance to happen, three of the guys bring up these much older women on the stage. So like, you know, women who are like over the age of 50, maybe 60 are on stage, and they're just like giggling of delight as these three guys give them the lap dance that Channing Tatum showed them how to do earlier. And all three of them are fucking killing it. Like, they're doing such an incredible job with it. Like, they seem like Channing Tatum now, that they have that energy. And it brought me to tears. It was just such an amazing moment, like such a beautiful climax of like what they were trying to build with that show, that Channing Tatum had taught these people how to bring pleasure to these women, like how to find joy through the art of dance. It's just like moments like that happened over and over in the movie that kept making me cry.
Sounds lovely. I'm excited to see it. I'll probably try and see it this weekend, though I haven't watched any of the other Magic Mike, so I need to do all of that too.
I mean, you definitely don't need to watch them for like you're not going to be able to not make sense of the story, but it is emotionally satisfying to watch all three.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was a big fan of the Step Up movies. I don't know if they're anything alike, but just like Channing Tatum dancing movies.
Other than Channing Tatum's boyish charm, there's not much to like about them.
He is charming, isn't he?
I love Channing Tatum. Like, to me, he is... I don't know if this moniker is used for him very much, but to me, he's a modern James Dean. Like, he's very watchable and very entertaining, but he also, like, at least early on in his career, he had that kind of rebellious nature. But now I just kind of think of him as, like, a really good actor. Like, he's, like, such a perfect movie star, like, in quotes, as we call them. Like, he's not necessarily, like, a thespian. Like, he's not, like, somebody who's going to do an accent and, like, embody this other person. But he's just, like, he's so good at being himself. It's incredible to watch him.
Yeah, I just, like, I always come away very, we just use the word charm, but charmed from things I watch, from, like, the first Step Up movie to even the, like, 21 and 22 Jump Streets, like, The Lost City recently. Like, everything I've ever watched him in, he's typically, like, the best part.
Yeah, love him.
So where did Last Dance end up ranking for you for, like, 2023 in the year, or in all time?
So for all-time rankings, I'm up to 329 movies, and of movies I've watched since the beginning of 2022, so Magic Mike's Last Dance is up at 72.
Okay. Where's XXL?
XXL is number 4.
Okay. So a little bit of a gap between those two.
Magic Mike XXL is above Lawrence of Arabia. So, like, that's if that paints a picture of me properly. For 2023, it would be number 2 because Knock at the Cabin would be number 1.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. What do you got for me, Chris?
So, of the 6 movies I watched, the one that I ended up ranking the highest in my all-time ranking was Midsommar.
Oh, man. I've never seen it.
Oh, I didn't realize you'd never watched it. I'd be really curious, because it's on that edge of what you were talking about between, like, the cynicism and the beauty. Like, I think they're... I could see you either being, like, completely blown away by some of the choices it makes, especially near the end, or just turned off by, like, cynicism aspects. Mm-hmm. But it was my first time watching it since theaters. And in theaters, I liked it all right, but I didn't think it was, like, mind-blowing the way that I thought Hereditary was mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. But I rewatched Hereditary recently, like, third time, and still enjoyed it. But rewatching Midsommar and having, like, a deeper understanding of Hereditary and now writing about Midsommar, I've come to appreciate some of the nuance in the movie a lot more, and the conversation each of those movies is having. Like, Hereditary is very much about grief and ends up as hyperbole, exaggeration, a defamiliarization of what happens when grief wins, when mm-hmm. it consumes you, takes over, and all of that is really displayed in the like possession and demonic stuff and the tragedy that strikes this family. But that could be told in a very grounded, realistic way. Midsummer is the other side of the coin, where you recover from grief. Hmm. And what does that recovery from grief entail? And again, it's defamiliarized, so like going to a cult in Sweden and having your like friends murdered is not like the path to get over grief. But there's something defamiliarized in the fact that like the friends in this case were pretty toxic. They were part of a package of Danny's toxic relationship with Christian. They were Christian's friends, and they put up with Danny. They didn't offer her support in the wake of the tragedy that she has at the beginning of the movie. So there's this idea that in being at this cult, this commune for this midsummer ceremony, she's actually experiencing what a support system looks like now that she no longer has a family. All that she has is this toxic relationship that she starts to discover through this cult, the idea of support and family and what it means to like be held and seen and have somebody like be in your emotions with you.
Hmm.
Honestly, there's a scene that just like kind of moves me to tears when I think about it. It's such a bizarre scene because Danny's having a panic attack and the women from the commune come and like collapse on the ground with her and start breathing in unison with her. And when she cries, they cry. When she screams, they scream. And it can be very jarring, I think, to somebody that's just like, what the hell is going on?
Mm.
But when you start to realize that it's because she won the May Queen, she's now like part of the family, and that this is the way they support their family that's in pain, there's such like power and beauty and catharsis by the end of the movie that I was pretty like into it the second time.
Nice.
It is funny though, because it is just like a defamiliarized like breakup story in a way too, like bringing Danny to a point where she finds catharsis in her grief and breaks up with Christian. And what does that look like? So the movie feels a lot bigger than what it is and a lot weirder than what it is, but it's a lot of window dressing and defamiliarization of a very basic story. So a lot of the stuff that people are like, what's going on? Why is that? It's just like, it's a weird cult.
Yeah.
That's it. Like, but there's not the supernatural elements. There's not anything like, I at least don't think all that deeper. Like, you could maybe start to make a case about like America and technology, but I don't think the movie really goes down that road at
interesting.
All,
so. It's interesting. Yeah. You're kind of painting it as simple at its heart, like what it's about.
Yeah.
Well, you and I both know that because we've done our research of all the movies searched for to be explained, Midsummer's in here at the top, right?
Yeah, very much.
What is that then? What is it that seems so confusing to people?
It's the cult rituals. So I think also like Hereditary, so many people saw Hereditary and the supernatural aspects of that were very real. Like, we're supposed to take those seriously. It's not like, is there a demon? No, there's demons.
Mm.
So I think when there are aspects of Midsummer that get like kind of trippy, like they sacrifice this guy in something called like a blood eagle way where the lungs are pulled out from the back and made to look like wings.
Mm-hmm.
There's a time where the main characters are drugged. So all the flowers that are on this table are kind of like pulsing and breathing, but it's not a first person perspective. It's like a subjective third because our perspective characters are drugged. We're seeing some of the like trippy things that they're seeing. But there would be people that are just like, why is that happening? Is there this supernatural element since everything's moving and breathing? There's a conspiracy theory that one of the guys might have been responsible for the death of the main character's family, which is just like one of those conspiracy theories that people really overextend.
Yeah, sure.
So, I mean, there are kind of, there's a ceremony, like some ceremonies that aren't necessarily explained. It's more of just like, that's weird. Is there anything going on? More so than there's actually something going on. It's just like, no, that's weird, but that's like a cult that's cut off from the rest of the world.
That all makes sense. Like the idea of people having theories about this movie, like it must just inspire some sort of cultish following because people seem obsessed with it. Like there's a Reddit page for Midsommar. Like there's not even a Reddit page probably for The Godfather or something, you know, like people are obsessed with it. And I have friends who dressed up as characters from the movies once, like from the movie. I it's just funny that it inspired that in people.
And I think that it's one of those movies that because it's defamiliarized, people don't understand quite why they resonate with it so much. But it is such a familiar story in terms of being in a bad relationship and getting out of it that I think there's a connection people feel without even realizing that they're like what it is, why it is. So the movie has legs in a way that I think others can feel a bit more forgotten.
Mm. Yeah, when you describe it, it definitely sounds more appealing to me than what Hereditary does. Because I watched it last year, and of the 329 movies on my list, it ranks at 329.
Wow.
I was very shaken by them because it's a movie about like grief and everything. Like you said, it's something like I think anybody can inherently connect to. But I think for me, you know, when you're describing the women crying with each other in Midsommar, like to me, that has more sympathy and compassion than anything I saw in Hereditary, which to me just felt very one note in its kind of ugliness and torture of the characters. Like I had a hard time finding like any sort of nuance or beauty in the struggle with grief and everything.
Yeah, I think the movie wanted to take that like very cynical approach of like, this is what grief can be.
For sure.
And when it's that singular and that like ugly of a thing to be detailing, that can be a huge turnoff.
Yeah, so I guess I get why it works for people, but it's my kryptonite.
You've seen, I know I've asked you this before, we talked about this before, but Melancholia?
Yeah, love Melancholia.
I could see Hereditary and Melancholia kind of being like similar. It's just Melancholia is a much better movie.
Yeah, that's it. To me, it's just more of like a case of style there. Like, obviously, they're both grim movies. Melancholia, like the world's ending. It's just maybe the way Lars von Trier navigates his characters and presents them. It's just a completely different energy.
Yeah, but I think of the movies like kind of like Hereditary's the like Charmander and
for sure
Melancholia is the Charizard,
right?
Midsommar for me came in at number 19 for my all-time rankings.
And how many movies you got?
87.
All right,
so it's at the, what category is it in? I have it at the top of the really good category.
Nice.
So just below impressive, amazing, and colossal.
Very, very good.
At Merrill West Credit Union, we're working towards a brighter financial future for both our members and our community, knowing that when you succeed, we all succeed. That starts with a solid financial foundation. As a credit union, we have no stockholders demanding profits. Our commitment is to our members. Experience the difference with our Money Market Max Bonus promotion, offering a cash incentive for letting us protect and grow your money. Merrill West Credit Union, working for you. Today, tomorrow, together. Merrill West Credit Union is insured by NCUA.
All right. Now we get to talk about our worst movie?
Yeah. What was the one that you ranked the lowest?
The one I actually ranked the lowest, I don't really want to talk about because it would be a boring discussion.
What was it though?
It's called The Automat. I don't know why I gave it such a French pronunciation. It's about, you know what The Automat is? Like the, you put a coin in like a little slot and like it opens up a little door and you pull out food.
Oh, yeah.
It's like an old timey thing that exists in like the Depression era. It was a movie all about the Automats. When maybe it's pronounced Automat. Maybe that's why I'm saying it. But I feel like it'd be Automat. Anyway, it's a movie. It was a history of all that. It was a documentary. And I was just really annoyed by how reverent it was about big business. Like, it, as somebody who despises capitalism, like, it wasn't what I thought it would be. Like, it's only kind of about this strange piece of American history, but then it ends up like asking you to feel sorry for like these idiots who had a bad idea that didn't sustain, and how it became the blueprint for soulless corporations like Starbucks and McDonald's. I was supposed to sit there and be like, oh darn. But still, there was some interesting stuff in it.
Okay.
Anyway, I would say that the lowest ranked movie I'm going to talk about, though, is You People.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That was one. Did we talk about it the week before, like the previous ranking episode?
We were supposed to, but then we ended up talking about Tar the whole time.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So we can both talk about You People if you'd like.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I guess to me, you know, I got to say, the first 45 minutes.
Yes.
Were very fun. Like, it was an awesome mix of like entertaining and like reflective. Like, it was truly meditative about like the state of America and how divisive politics have gotten, and the sort of natural separation that exists between races as we're trying to like coexist in America. It was cool how it handled both of those energies really well and kind of allowed them to blend, and they created its own aesthetic where people are interacting and like the jokes are funny and born from like this racial divide. Like, all of it worked so well. Like, even the gags they were doing, like Eddie Murphy's Koofy getting caught on fire, like all of it reminded me of old timey like slapstick comedies. Like, the formula was just like so good. And then on a dime, all of a sudden, the movie like turns into melodrama and like forgets how to be funny and just turns into a series of like monologues and soapboxing and just like really uninteresting, tropish dynamics between characters. Like, everything about it just like stopped being interesting to me.
Yeah, it was really kind of infuriating because I found Jonah Hill and Laura London like very charming together. And like the scenes that they had, I liked. And then once it started forcing the tension between characters and like escalating things, like there were so many scenes that started to feel forced and like silly and cheesy to me that I couldn't, my interest just fell off a cliff.
Yeah.
And by the time we got to like the nadir of the movie and all the stuff falling apart, I was so angry, especially at the fact that the couple kind of like quit on each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like they chose the ignorance of their family ahead of like one another, which was kind of disappointing to me. Which I get, like, you know, some people prioritize family, some people prioritize like the relationship, but I guess given how much they meant to each other in that first part, and I get the idea of wanting to show that, like, you know, people can be in love, but family can be an issue. That's something that people really do face. It just, I didn't buy into it as necessarily earned either way.
Yeah.
Especially with how like frustrated both of them were with each of their families.
Totally. Yeah, I completely agree. I didn't feel honest about their characters and where the places they had gotten to.
Yeah, they started to feel like chess pieces.
Yes.
Or in this case, checkers pieces.
Like, wait, why all like checkers pieces?
Just because they was such a dumb, like dumbed down.
Okay. I would say chess pieces because it's black and white. Okay. But to each their own.
Yeah. It's that's the dad joke.
Yeah, that's my just unfathomable attempt at humor.
I especially the very end pissed me off.
It's pretty bad.
Just the fact that it's, I get the surprise reunion, like the parents working it out and being like, all right, like you crazy kids. Like, can you get back together now? That's fine. But then taking it to the wedding, is such like surprise. We brought everybody here, and it's like,
and you're ready to get married, right? Like, you've worked everything out. Like, let's just step right into marriage.
Yeah, you've had, what was it, 3 months?
You haven't seen each other in 3 months, yeah.
Yeah, not talking, not associating, but you're ready just to, like, pick things up because we apologized.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. It's one of those things where, and this is going to extend to the next movie that I talk about.
All right.
I have found my tolerance for movie logic to be slipping.
Wait, for movies that have illogical plots?
To where it's just like, well, it's just a movie. Like, you know, people don't care. Like, that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
To where the thing happening is more important than how it happened. Which might get into some of the post-cinema discussion.
Okay, so you're saying your talents for movies that disregard the logic for plot is waning.
A little bit. Or okay.
I was going to say, I thought it was already at an all-time low. Like, I thought you had no patience for it to begin with.
Yeah, maybe it's not, like, disregard logic, but that, like, take shortcuts for the sake of efficiency. Like, we talked about with The Lost City, where they get saved, and then it cuts to everybody being on a Hawaiian island.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, we're told that she got home, wrote a new book, released the book, went on a press tour, and now they're at the end of the press tour, and finally, like, oh my God, Sandra Bullock and Channing Tatum are, like, concluding the conversation they started about liking each other, even though they've been on a book tour this whole time together. So it's like, it's nonsense, but because the movie just wanted to skip to everybody being on the island and having this beautiful ending, like that kind of thing, I shouldn't think too hard about it because, you know, it's not that deep of a movie. But on the other hand, like, come on. And it's the same thing with this, like, wedding at the end of You People. It's like, I shouldn't think too hard about it. Like, okay, they get married. Like, it's a nice moment. And it's just, like, the energy of, like, we know they're going to be together. But the logic of it, like, the oh, don't think too hard about it is infuriating to me.
All right. We're probably going to launch into dark territory. I feel like a repeat of Tar coming on. Like, we may not come out of this, but I have been interested to have this conversation with you. And to preface all this, I agree with you about You People. Like, that whole wedding ending doesn't feel very earned, but I think maybe we're taking a little bit different approaches to it on how why it's not earned. Okay, so for you, the logic of it makes sense. So when you say that, do you mean that when we bring in the logic of, like, the real world, when you think about this movie in terms of, like, how the real world operates, them stepping into this wedding makes no sense? Or do you mean within the logic of this movie, with, like, where these characters are at, it doesn't make sense?
Both.
Okay, so that's what I want to get at. So when you watch movies, you bring the real world in the movies. You expect movies to follow, like, the patterns and motions of, like, how you and I live.
It depends on what the movie's done up to that point. If it's been, so it's like a case by case basis. Like, if I'm watching Tar, for example, to go back to that, I would be amazed if suddenly there's, like, fast travel or, I mean, I guess there are supernatural elements in that
movie. I don't necessarily mean supernatural stuff.
Yeah, but, like, the logic of Tar, I would be a little more strict on than, say, the logic of Top Gun Maverick, or where I know that it's, like, heightened, it's over the top. Like, same thing with, like, comparing a movie like Heat to a movie like John Wick. I wouldn't bring the same, like, degree of logic to John Wick that I would to Heat, because I feel like they're establishing a little more of the heightened ideas. So it's like, You People, there is a heightenedness to it, but they've been dealing with such, like, normal reactions or semi-normal reactions to like life and one another, and just broke up over very like logical, like we thought through this and it makes sense that like we shouldn't be together because their parents can't get together, to then just go into the wedding feels kind of like stupid to me based on like the tone of what had already like happened and been established. So it's not like I'm just judging everything based on like real world logic, but it's kind of a subjective sensitivity based on what like I think the movie has been doing up to that point.
Interesting. I have to say I really take a very different approach. I've been reading this book. It's called The Story of Art. Do you know this book?
No.
Who wrote that? E.H. Goodrich? Is that that guy's name?
Gombrich.
Yeah, E.H. Gombrich. I knew it was some wacky name like that. And it sounds like it could be dry, but it's actually kind of a fascinating read. It's literally going through the history of art and kind of going through just how art developed and how different aesthetics were established. And the one commonality I've noticed with the history of art is like the tone and the formula used for different civilizations' art varies, but they're all trying to do the same thing. Like, so even if somebody's drawing something that doesn't properly depict the human figure versus somebody who is trying to capture, like fully capture the dimensions of the human figure, like they're both expressing something similar. They're both trying to express some form of humanity, like something they experience in their everyday. I completely bring that attitude to movies where a movie like Heat or John Wick, to me, they're both movies. They're both art. I agree with you. I don't expect a spaceship to fly down in the middle of Heat, and I wouldn't expect to be okay with that. In my mind, like both of those movies have an aesthetic. Like both of those movies have an emotional drive, something they're trying to express about life, and whatever path they need to take to get there is fine with me. The only time I see illogic in quotes is if they stray outside that aesthetic. Any time where something feels incongruous or feels deceptive or just flat out like takes it on a different course that doesn't contribute to like the foundation of the movie, you know, the ideological foundation of the movie and what it's trying to say. So this is why I was asking about it, because like I feel like a lot of times when we complain about like the logic in a movie, it's because we're applying real world logic to a movie. But a movie isn't the real world. It's a piece of art. It's a reflection of something. So like in You People, to me, that's why the wedding doesn't fit, because in my mind, You People completely missed this opportunity to be, to use this kind of old-timey formula, to be a bit slapsticky, to have a lot more scenes like the koofy catching on fire, like all of these misunderstanding and like farcical situations where characters are forced to confront, you know, the horrors of life, the discrimination in the world, the separation they feel, all of that. If they just cut out like all the extra shit that's boring, like the monologuing and the soapboxing, like if they just focused on like the energy of those kinds of interactions, like to me, the movie would have had more life and would have had a way more focused aesthetic. And if that had happened the whole movie, if it had been more efficient, more focused, and cut out all the fluff, like the wedding at the end might have actually fit. Like I might have actually felt congruous to everything that had happened and didn't need to like feel real in quotes, like the real world, but would have been real to this world, would have made sense. Does that all make sense?
That makes sense, but I don't think we're too far off in what we're saying.
Maybe not.
It's just like the way in which we're saying it, because what you're essentially describing is if the movie had different logic, then it would like, because all what I'm saying is like all the scenes adding up create kind of like the sensitivity range to which something like fits or feels like believable within the established world.
Mm-hmm.
And if something doesn't feel like it fits into what's been established, that to me is when I say like the logic is off. And or it can be like literal to where like they say that in Batman or The Dark Knight Rises that the bridges are patrolled by Bane's men and the National Guard's there. So when does Batman have the time to paint like a giant flaming bat symbol from the top of this bridge? And like
that's where we tools differ.
Like that's where it bothers me, because so much of the movie has like logistical exactitude in ways, or like is grounded in some of what's happening in terms of like the heightenedness, to where that bothers me. But in You People, it's something to where it's like the wedding kind of just like feels shoved in there based on everything that we had seen. And what you're saying is if they had removed a bunch of scenes, changed like the flow of the movie, essentially there's a way that it fits. And that's kind of what I'm saying as well.
Okay, so we're on the same page about You People, it seems. But I will say your comment about which Batman movie was that?
The Dark Knight Rises.
I don't even remember that stupid movie. But still, like, maybe that's where I kind of differ, is like when you're describing something like that, which to me is just like a boring plot device. Like, it doesn't matter to me. Like, maybe I'm only concerned about the logic when it comes to just like the pure aesthetic and emotion of a movie. And I really don't care when it comes to like little stuff like that. And that's why the wedding bothers me in You People, because like it's a climactic moment. Like there should be like such incredible energy and heart to this moment. And it just feels really tacked on and stupid.
They CGI'd the wedding kiss too.
I saw you tweet that. I didn't even know what that meant. Like how did they, in what way did they CGI it?
They don't, like, the actors didn't actually kiss. They, like, got close, and then they CGI in, like, the actual, like, lips touching.
For what reason? They'd kissed earlier in the movie.
I have no idea. You see just, like, Laura London's face just, like, morph when they go to make contact. It's very strange. What my one that I ranked the least.
Lowest. Do you want to know where I ranked You People?
Oh yeah, where did you rank You People?
290 for the all-time rankings, and probably dead last for 2023. Right, it's got to be at the bottom. No, Pale Blue Eyes at the bottom. So it's number four for me in 2023. I've only seen five movies.
Okay, I put it above, or it's bottom for me. I put it below Pale Blue Eye.
Yeah, I just can't. As much as I don't like You People, it wins for me because it's entertaining, at least for some of it. None of the Pale Blue Eye was entertaining to me, so it loses.
It's funny, like Pale Blue Eye to me, it was more of the visuals and like costume and like whole like the setting,
sure,
and the sense of place that won for me.
That makes sense, yeah.
Yeah. Well, okay, so I have Jurassic World Dominion, especially when we're talking about like movie logic.
Your bottom?
Yeah, that was the one that was the lowest one for me.
Oh boy, Chris, here we go.
Yeah. I like how that shocked you. Like, you're saying
I'm genuinely shocked, yeah.
Yeah,
that, I there's nothing terrible not to love about that movie.
Out of 87 movies, it's 81.
Oof. That's hereditary territory. I don't like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's just all the callbacks felt so like and maybe it's the thing where like to you it's fun.
It
like,
is, yeah.
I could see a lot of the things that like frustrated me being things that delighted you. But like I want Jurassic Park, right? That's the thing in terms of like quality, tone that I'm looking for. And the Jurassic World trilogy has been so far from that,
yeah,
that it upsets me. And I get that there's something to just appreciating the movies for what they are, but I think what these movies are is like some of the things that I hate most. Especially when it comes to like the blockbuster. Like my idea of a great like big blockbuster movie is Casino Royale, which is not your style of big blockbuster movie.
I mean, I don't like Casino Royale, but I guess it's not my favorite.
No, like, you far prefer more of the energy of, like, the Fast and Furious movies.
Oh, hell yeah. Now we're talking.
Where I feel like the Jurassic World trilogy is a lot closer to Fast and Furious than it is to Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
So it just, it left me, like, really annoyed. Like, all the callbacks, like, over and over and over again feel so forced to me. And maybe that's something, too, to where, like, if this was a purely meta movie, and there are times where it felt like it wanted to be, especially all the scenes with, oh my God, what's his name?
Chris Pratt?
No.
Sam Neill?
Jeff Goldblum. Oh. Like, Jeff Goldblum, almost every line of dialogue he has feels like it's not breaking the fourth wall, but like meta, mm-hmm. and can be applied to the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Which I really liked. And in that way, like, when I'm starting to think about it through that, like, all of the forced callbacks, all of, like, the people standing and doing, like, the handout raptor
mm-hmm.
motion, there's something that starts to be self-aware and fascinating. But then there are long stretches of the movie that lack that energy for me entirely, where it just, yeah. it's just dumb. Like, not even dumb in terms of, like, logic. It's just, I think the choices that they were making were, like, uninteresting. Sure. Just the fact that there's the one scene where Bryce Dallas Howard parachutes out and lands in the jungle, and the dinosaur with the long fingers, which is a dinosaur. I know most dinosaurs, but I don't know that dinosaur.
I know most dinosaurs is the name of your memoir, right?
Now it is. But she just starts crawling along the ground and it's following her, and then goes into water and kind of floats down beneath the surface, and it screams and leaves. It's just so...
You make me want to watch this movie again.
Dumb. And it's not dumb in the sense of...
Right.
Bad. It's dumb in the sense of, why would, like, of the infinite choices that you had to do something that's interesting, dynamic, exciting, why was this what you landed on? And I think that's just what I keep coming back to in the movie. Like, is this really the best thing you could think of? Is this really the best thing you could think of? Over and over and over and over again. And the final fight between the Tyrannosaurus Rex and the Gigantosaurus?
No. Yeah, it was so good, right?
I hated it. What, like, it's the most unearned thing I've ever seen in a movie. Like, completely unearned. You have one scene earlier where the Gigantosaurus, I say I know most dinosaurs, but I can't pronounce this one and it's bothering me. it's one of the newer ones, you know?
Yeah.
It's not Gigantosaurus.
I hope there's a...
What is it?
A dinosaur called a Gigantosaurus.
There should be one called Gigantosaurus. But what is... Wikipedia, come here. All right. At the very end...
This is the most entertaining part of the podcast so far.
I can't. It is, right? Me trying to pronounce dinosaur names. Gigantosaurus.
This could be a whole podcast itself.
I can't say it. I can't, like, wrap my mind around.
That's okay.
I've never had to say it out loud. G.
The G-Man.
The big G. Yeah, G-Man facing the Tyrannosaurus. Like, they have the one scene earlier where... the Tyrannosaurus is going after something and cowers to Big G because Big G is like the biggest carnivore. And then to suddenly have them fight and be territorial, it was so dumb to me. And it should be something that I love, that I'm invested in. Like, oh, we get to see a dinosaur fight. And instead, it just struck me as... completely hollow and cheesy and annoying. It annoyed me.
Yeah, it sounds like anybody who's uninitiated, like Chris loves dinosaurs and loves Jurassic Park. You've loved it since you were a kid. So like I have that reaction to some movies, like the new Scream movie and the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre movie. Like I'm all for movies establishing their own aesthetic, but when you really love something, when it feels like something's abusing what you love, like I could see that driving you nuts, and it sounds like that's what happened to you.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. And you know, maybe it's something if they're remaking, rebooting, like starting fresh, but the fact that it's supposed to be part of the same world
yeah.
is just so like stupid to me.
Yeah, it is funny that it is part of the same world, but it's doing its own thing. Again, I'm much more forgiving of that. Like, I'm all for a movie that exists in the same universe, in quotes, like establishing its own style and aesthetic and everything, but I could see it being infuriating as well.
Well, it's like one of the whole character arcs for Sam Neill in the first one is the fact that he doesn't like kids at the beginning, and then by the end he like grows to care about these kids,
mm-hmm.
and there's such a positivity to that ending, to then just have it be like, oh yeah, he went back to archaeology and has been like lonely for the last 30 years and has no kids, has no like marriage. It's just like, what's the point of the character journey of the first movie then? Like,
things happen to people, Chris.
I know, but that should be a story in and of itself, not just...
Well, maybe they'll make a movie that's, you know, in between Jurassic World and Jurassic Park.
I mean, Sam Neill's still... He's still looking good.
Man, those people... Okay, you were annoyed by the movie, but everybody in those movies, like, did their fucking job. You have, like, Sam Neill, Laura Dern, and Jeff Goldblum specifically, like, all killed it.
They were good. I just kept thinking every scene, I'm like, when they called cut, do they just look at each other and go, well, the paycheck?
They looked out at their paychecks. They looked at their bank account.
Yeah. Are they like what kind of discussions were happening in between the scenes is what I kept thinking.
I don't know, man. I thought the fervor was there. Like, I thought they all had great energy. I mean, as you pointed out, Jeff Goldblum, like, he's eating it up. He's chewing up the scenery. There's like no film left at the end. He's chewing up so much of it. Like, and everything you were saying about like the meta-ness, like, I think that's key to loving the movie. I don't know if just because of like the style of the movie and the fact that it's attached to a franchise you loved, it doesn't seem like you could have loved what it was doing. But personally, as somebody, I mean, I've always loved the Jurassic Park movies. I don't think I have the same kind of attachment to it that you do. Personally was completely on board with it. I loved how meta it was, and I thought it became part of what the movie was saying about movies and like the franchise itself and like our relationship with it and our ability to be entertained by it. Like, there's just something really, like, it was so ridiculous. Like, the more ridiculous I got, like, the more I felt the message became profound. So if anybody's out there like who's like me and can watch movies that way, like, I say seek it out and watch it.
I very much so. If anybody is nodding their head to things that you say in the show, they would probably love Jurassic World Dominion.
Fuck yeah. The other thing about this movie is I'm somebody who's always loved... I've always liked movies. And I remember my freshman year of college, like, I started watching a lot more movies and got into them. But I think my true love for movies and what painted how I love movies now is when I started watching movies with people a lot more. And to me, this is a perfect movie for watching with a group of people. Like, it is so insane and ridiculous that like it kind of becomes part of the fun of it. And the more you're invested in like what it's doing to me, the more the movie exposes what it's trying to do, you know, philosophically and shit. Like, it to me, it all starts to come together and gel.
The moment that it almost came together for me was when they had Bryce Dallas Howard in the foot race with the Velociraptor assassin.
Great scene.
And she's like running over the rooftops of Malta chased by this assassin velociraptor, a highly trained assassin velociraptor, and outpacing it. And I was like, all right, they know exactly what they're doing.
Well, yes.
This is like so absurd that I could start to get on board, and then too many other scenes lost me.
Now, what if they had inserted a flashback of Bryce Dallas Howard training on the track and getting faster and faster?
If they had opened the movie with that.
Wow. How stupid would that have been?
If they opened the movie with Bryce Dallas Howard doing sprint training on a track, I would be completely sold on this movie.
I'm not going to lie. I probably would enjoy it.
Like, that's the kind of stuff I want.
Yeah. So you wanted the movie to go even dumber, really?
Yes.
You're complaining about it being dumb, but you want it even more dumb.
Yes.
All right.
Yes, I did.
Okay. So, do we want to talk about the rest of these movies that we watched?
Yeah. What else was on your list?
All right. So, we talked about Knock at the Cabin at 31. Magic Mike's Last Dance, 72. The next one would be another Channing Tatum flick, Step Up. Came in at 131 for me. And then we have Step Up 3D. That's right. I watched more than one Step Up movie this week. That came in at number 160. I'm a big fan of that movie.
It was good.
Yeah. Casino, Martin Scorsese. I had never seen that movie. Comes in at 169. Very much enjoyed that one.
I've also always meant to watch it, but never have.
I'd be curious to hear your reaction to it, because it's maybe the only movie I've ever seen that has constant narration. Like, I think it might drive you wild.
Oh, no. Yeah, maybe.
Because Goodfellas has a lot of narration, but it feels... There's definitely less of it in Goodfellas, and it also feels more part of the story and, like, what the movie's trying to do. Whereas in Casino, like, while I really loved the movie and, like, I found it very enlightening, it's also, like, the constant narration was a little aggravating sometimes to me. So for you, I feel like it would be unfathomable.
Yeah. No, this will... Okay.
It's literally the whole movie.
I'm really
curious. Really bizarre. Like, bizarre to the point where you're like, wow, like, this is such a bold choice. Like, you kind of respect it, but maybe you won't respect it.
Okay.
Down at number 243, so we're jumping way down here, Step Up to the Streets. That one doesn't quite work for me, but it's got some good parts. And then, oh, this is one that'll interest you, Chris, because early on in our movie-going relationship, do you remember this? Like, we had a period where we were making each other watch a movie, like we traded off.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe the first one you had me watch was Sullivan's Travels.
I do remember that.
And I didn't really care for it then, and I watched it again because I was all prepared to love it, because now I'm a bona fide Preston Sturges fan, but I still just couldn't quite get on board with it. So I have it at 246.
Okay. It's been like, I mean, that was one of the ones that I watched in college for a class.
Yeah. It's a total class movie.
Yeah. Maybe it's the kind of thing where, like, now I would also be like, okay, that was good then, but I've seen a lot more.
Yeah. I think it's one of those movies that, like, you understand, like, the second you watch it and, like, you see the ending and you see what it's going for, you get why it's revered. Like, it's a movie about, like, the art of comedy and the love of movies. You know, it's this, like, thing the AFI would throw on their list and point towards being like, this is what movies are all about. But I find it kind of flawed and flimsy. Like, it doesn't quite earn what it purports to earn. So anyway, then at 257, I have Black Panther.
Black Panther or Black Panther Wakanda Forever?
Not Wakanda Forever. Still got to watch that one.
Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah. I got it on... I had the same reaction to this movie I did the first time. This is the first time I've seen it since theaters. I bought it on 4K, and I was eager to rewatch it because I was like, I'll probably like it this time. And I still just had problems with it. Like, I love everybody in the movie. Like, I think everybody in the movie is doing great work. I just think, like, the action scenes, the CGI, like, so much of it is just done so poorly that it's really hard for me to get past.
Oh, wait until you watch Wakanda Forever.
Okay. I mean, I plan to watch it. Of all the Marvel movies, these are like the only ones I actually want to watch, but now I don't know.
I mean, they're the performances, again, kind of carry the day at Wakanda Forever. Specifically to Angela Bassett. Ooh,
she's the best.
She just like, she crushes. Like, there's a point in the movie when you're watching where you're just like, what is she on and why is nobody else on it? Like, that's, it's just like, man, she's so good in it. It's like nice that she got an Oscar nomination.
Oh yeah, it's awesome.
But like, the action sequences are such a step back.
Ooh, that it's step kind back of from what I just watched. Oh boy.
Yeah.
Anyway, and then you people at 290 and the automat at 294.
The automat.
Okay, what do you got for me?
Okay. I had number 19 was Midsommar, like we talked about. Then number 45 was No Time to Die.
Oh, okay.
Which, like, 45 is at, let me get
right in the middle. Like,
right, that is right in the middle. It's near the lower end of the positives category. Like, the positives is the longest, like, category that I have right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, it carries 29 through 51, and it's coming in, like, in the lower third of that.
Okay.
Which, like, just made me sad that Casino Royale was the best of them.
If you had to rank the Daniel Craig movies, how would you do it?
Casino Royale, Spectre, or sorry, no.
Skyfall.
Casino Royale, Skyfall. Then fuck, it's just like a brawl for the bottom.
Yeah.
Quantum of Solace is definitely like the worst.
Oh wow.
And then, though,
most people think that. I don't know why I said oh wow. Like, everybody thinks that.
I haven't seen it since theaters, so maybe it's the one that I've watched least. Maybe I would find some charm in it now that the series is over, but it was the one that like bothered me the most on first watch. Yeah. And then I thought Spectre was like pretty like awful.
Mm-hmm.
And No Time to Die was kind of like, I just, the way you feel about Channing Tatum is how I kind of feel about Daniel Craig.
Uh-huh.
I just find him incredibly like interesting, charming. Like, I'm into everything he's in except for Cowboys and Aliens.
Which, by the way, I've always wanted to watch.
I just hate Damon Lindelof movies so much.
Well, didn't he just produced it though, right?
He wrote it.
Because Cowboys and Aliens was directed by Jon Favreau.
Yeah,
that's why I want to watch it.
It's a script by,
okay, yeah,
what's his name?
So you hate his writing, I get it. Yeah,
yeah, it's just all like mystery at the beginning with horrible payoff. It's always a horrible payoff.
It's
the
just only lost time it's in a movie.
Yeah, the only time it's not horrible payoff is The Leftovers, and that's because he was working with a novelist who could be like, "Hey, let's do this instead." Everything else, he's just on his own, and it's insanely frustrating. Stupid Lindelof movies. But so Daniel Craig in No Time to Die, like, I like him a lot. It makes up for some of the like huge issues I have with that movie, especially the more that I think about it. Mm-hmm. But I was it pained by what's his face, the guy from
Remy Malek,
previous movie Spectre.
Christoph Waltz.
Yeah, Christoph Waltz. His performance was puzzling to me. Where I really like him, so I thought I was excited when he was Blofeld, and then I thought he like actively missed the mark. So the fact that he's not all throughout this movie was better.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. As you're talking about your rankings, I'm realizing that like I like all the movies, actually. I really like Quantum of Solace, and I'd be interested to hear what you think when you rewatch it. because like the whole movie is just Daniel Craig dealing with like losing the woman he lost in Casino Royale. Like I was kind of struck by how committed the movie is to that story. And in that way, isn't really a Bond movie at all, in the way that like Bond movies like really extend and blow up to all these crazy avenues. The only one I really don't like is No Time to Die.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Why did you like it?
I can find stuff to like in all the movies. I actually really like Spectre. I didn't like it the first time, but something about just like the flow and energy of that movie, I was with it the second time, so I liked it. But No Time to Die, I mean, it's the second time I've said this on the podcast now, and I'm realizing that it's something I can't stand in movies. It's like the reverence a movie can have for something. Like the movie's such a hand job to like Daniel Craig as Bond, you know? Like it's a send off for him and how great his character was, and we're gonna miss him, and like, oh, look how heroic he is, like killing himself here at the end. Like, just the whole movie had that aura. Like I felt it from the very beginning in a way that I was just like, ugh. Like I guess like I like James Bond, but like I don't like it that much. Like I'm not gonna sit there and like wrap arms around with everybody and like swing in unison as we honor the great James Bond. Like I don't know. I couldn't get on board with any of that.
No, that bothered me. Like I didn't think of it as necessarily honoring Daniel Craig so much as like we're finally having Daniel Craig be James Bond.
Yeah, right.
That's what annoyed me, like with all the, again, like forced stuff that I thought was part of Jurassic World Dominion, except I guess Jurassic World Dominion you get a little more of the like haha, and No Time to Die it's just like really, like you got to force in the martini, you got to force in the name thing, you got to force in like the car, all this stuff that people complained was missing from Casino Royale, we finally have it. And it's like, I didn't want it. Like,
yeah,
right. I didn't want those things. I wanted like this new take on Bond, not for it to evolve to the old take on Bond.
Oh, you know what else I hated about that fucking movie is it's doing whatever apparently every franchise and every studio thinks it needs to do now is like build a universe. And it's trying to like set up this team, like at the end,
yeah.
You know, like they're going to carry us into the next movie for the next Bond. And I'm just like, I don't stop doing that. Stop making me stop trying to invest me in something I don't care about, please.
It's funny because I feel like for a long time, Mission Impossible was trying to emulate Bond. And that felt like something where they were trying to emulate the route that Mission Impossible went.
That's a good point. Yeah.
But and him, I thought it was cruel that they killed him. I get the idea of like Bond's a tragic figure and he's done all these things. He doesn't need to have like a happy ending. Maybe doesn't deserve a happy ending. But I think that should be developed more. Like I don't think they really earned killing him off, and I don't think most people wanted to see him killed off.
I just think it's flat out stupid. Like everything I just said with them trying to build a universe, like the only reason he's killed off is just so that he can be gone and they have to find a new Bond. Like that's not what the James Bond movies are. Like there's always just a new Bond. Like there's kind of a beauty to the emotional detachment in that way, that like when you're James Bond, you're expected to perish. You're expected to not be able to last in this job, where you're effectively giving up your life to save the world and fight terrorism. Like to turn it into this like sentimental thing where Bond dies heroically and like now we have to get a new Bond, like that is just so uninteresting to me.
Funny side note, the same guys that wrote Casino Royale wrote all the others.
Oh yeah.
It's just they sometimes weren't the like first writer. Like there was a different first writer, right, for Quantum of Solace, and then they brought back like those guys, and there are different like side writers that help them develop things, but they were involved in everything. They were also involved in like the last two Pierce Brosnan movies that were so horrible.
they did get worse as they went along. I mean, yeah, maybe the same writers were there the whole time, but in my mind, as I watch those movies, like, the studio's fingerprints are all over them. They're just like, they're just pounding people over the head saying, like, build a universe, build a universe.
Casino Royale, though, will always have Monaco.
You know what? I really want to watch that again. I think in the beginning, I was kind of a hater on Casino Royale, and maybe you're remembering that aspect of me that, like, I don't even remember. But I think I actually really like that movie. Maybe it's the best one.
I think it just kind of, it's crisper, I think, than all the others.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they, I feel like they had something to prove in a way that at the end they're like, oh, let's just get through this.
Skyfall, on the other hand, I've never been able to get on board with. Actually, of all, that would be number four for me.
I get torn on Skyfall because I really liked the first half. I didn't like the back half.
The Home Alone half?
Yeah, the Home Alone half. The Home Alone half was fucking weird.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so No Time to Die was at 45, but it could drop. I think there was just something about, like, the highs and some of the, like,
sure,
the scope that I liked, but I'd knock at the cabin. I'd say that because I've knocked at the cabin at 47. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Which still, like, in the positives category, it's just, it was a little smaller, and for it to be, like, as small as it is,
yeah,
I needed to, like, punch a little more for me.
Sure.
And then at 66, I had Sonic the Hedgehog 2.
Okay. I've never seen the first one, but I've always been interested.
The first one's, like, not bad. It's, like, inoffensive.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's moments where you're like, okay, I think they have something, but also it's still, like, a kid's movie. Sonic 2 was kind of, like, mixed. There are things that I, like, liked and I think they improved on, but then they also, like, force things, like, bringing James Marsden into, like, every fraughtful situation somehow. Like, and it's like, you don't have to just, like, force him into, like, every scene that Sonic's in.
Yeah. If I watch it, though, I'm there for Jim Carrey, and, like, that's about it.
Yeah, Jim Carrey, I think they utilized him better in the second one.
Okay.
So that was at 66. 68, which is a category down in negatives, I have La La Land.
Okay, that was the movie I watched three quarters of.
Okay. I find Emily Stone.
Emma Stone
and...
Gosling.
Ryan Gosling. I keep forgetting his name. For like the last 3 months, I forget his name every time.
You know, all these white Hollywood actors, they start to blend together at some point.
Yeah. Ryan Gosling, I find them both incredibly, like, charming and watchable.
Totally.
I find the story completely, like,
inane?
Cheesy. Yeah. Inane, like, repetitive. The only thing that I feel like Damien Chazelle's, like, bringing to the table with it is, like, the musical aspect. And even then, I didn't find the music all that interesting or charming.
No way.
Like, the piano, like, the main piano refrain is really, like, catchy. But,
Yeah, I was just, like, kind of, I had the same feeling, because I saw it in theaters, and I remember my only recollection of this movie from the theaters was I hated the beginning of the movie. Like, I hated the car scene. And then I hated the scene where they were in Emma Stone's apartment and all the girls were dancing. And then after that, like, the movie, like, came alive a little bit. And that is exactly what happened to me this time. Did not like the opening scenes. But the second Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone come together, like, they have such good energy and they're so watchable that they're able to carry the movie. But beyond that, like, I just, like, I feel like inane is the perfect word. Like, the story feels so, like, blah. Like, we're just, it's, all it is two people, like, trying to make it in Hollywood. Like, and it's not like their situations are any more fantastic than, like, anything you've ever seen in a movie about this exact situation. Like, it felt so ordinary. Yet it was, like, purporting itself to these, like, high levels, like with like the places music would go and like outrageous things people would do as they dance. Like none of it just felt, none of it felt congruous to me. Like I didn't know like what aesthetic was being established. I didn't, I wasn't, you know, under the charm of any of its whim or anything. Like I just was constantly just kind of like, is this what the movie's doing? Like, is it trying to be this? Like, I don't know. I just, I'm not,
it's, Go ahead.
No, I'm just not taken by it like everyone else is, it seems.
Yeah, I it spends such a long amount of time in the struggle period.
Yeah.
That the payoff to the eventual success was completely lacking for me. Like, Emma Stone goes off and we don't see any of it. We don't see her perform in her first role. We don't see them be completely like amazed by her performance. Is she just immediately naturally amazing in this role? Is it not difficult for her? Is it just, if she was that good of an actor, why wasn't she getting any of the roles before? Like, what was different about this? And what's that rise in popularity like for her? When she comes back, does she not try to connect with Ryan Gosling? Does he not answer her call? Like, there's so many interesting things that I think happen once Emma Stone's career takes off that the movie just completely skips over. And that was really, really...
Yeah. I mean, I don't necessarily need like all that at the end, but you're right in the sense of, like, the movie, again, it purports something that isn't actually happening. Like, it's asking us to just be like amazed by all this when like it's not giving us enough of, I guess, just like real human shit happening. Like, it's just so theatrical in a way that like it feels like nothing but theatrics sometimes, and there's no real humanity happening.
One of the things I pointed out when I did my write-up of the movie was that in the first 17 minutes of the movie, I think it was, it's the opening car scene, Emma Stone like at her job, back at the apartment. You don't run into Ryan Gosling, I think, until that like 17, 18 minute mark kind of thing when she goes in. So there's a lot that kind of happens in that period. The end of the movie is also something like 17 minutes, but it's just her picking up coffee, being at home, and then the 10-minute sequence of what their life could have been.
Right.
Which, like, what's that really... There's a tragedy to that, but it's just kind of a reverse flashback. Yeah. You're just shoving in something that never happened, I guess, for the emotional... And, I mean, clearly people respond to it. It's emotional. But to me, again, it was just like, well, we saw him have a happy point. Why do we have to see them have like even happier times?
Yeah.
Eh.
So as you can tell, I'm really excited to finish this movie.
Yeah, I'm sorry. But I will say, having watched La La Land, I do think he fixed a lot of the issues in Babylon.
Oh, okay.
But I don't think Babylon's like some great movie either, but it has been like growing on me. I've been I think about it a lot.
All 3 hours of it are growing on you.
Yeah. still flawed, but I think it's doing what La La Land wanted to do in like a much stronger way.
Man, to think of where that guy's gone since Whiplash.
I know, it's infuriating.
It's weird. Like, I don't even necessarily love Whiplash, but like it's really good. Like, I appreciate it. That La La Land is like a gigantic step down.
Yeah, yeah. And then I'd even bother seeing First Man because I don't know, like,
I would never watch that movie. It looks so boring.
I really like sci-fi space movies. I don't necessarily like historical NASA movies.
There are a lot of them.
There's so many of them. And like, I don't get the infatuation with it. I mean, okay, I do get the infatuation with the fact, like, we went to the moon. This is a scientific achievement. Like, amazing that should be heralded. It's just, I find the style that comes with it a little mechanical, and you know, maybe if I watch First Man, it would change my mind, but I feel like I've, everything that I see that's NASA related is typically the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. Is that it?
Yeah, it was La La Land and then Jurassic World Dominion.
Oh yeah, that's right. Wow. Like La La Land more than Jurassic World Dominion. Who are you, Chris?
And the depth of my anger at Jurassic World Dominion.
Honestly, you getting that angry at the movie makes me like it a little bit more. I'm happy to hear it.
Of course. That's my gift to you.
But anybody getting mad at that movie, would, it's not just you. But the fact that we're so close, like, it somehow increases the enjoyment.
All right.
All right. This is our longest episode yet.
Yeah.
It feels good.
It does. Well, you know, I had to get that out of the system.
Yeah, it feels good not to have a timer, you know?
Who would do that?
Nobody. Nobody I know.
Who puts artificial limits on things?
The end of this much, though, I have no idea what to say how to end this.
What's the next week's episode?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, we should do some plugs. Well, next week's episode, we are talking about everybody's favorite movie, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once.
We're going to lose whatever audience we've built up.
And when I say everybody's favorite movie, I mean everybody but two guys.
As differing as our views are, our view on this is pretty, like, united.
Yeah, although I will say I have to watch it again, so I could come away liking it a lot more. We'll see.
I
don't think it'll happen.
I can just imagine when we, like, start the podcast next week. Just be like, all right, Travis. And you're like, Chris.
It's number one for me now.
It happens. Yeah. I'm just like, no. No.
You will know that I've been infiltrated if that happens. Someone has gotten control of my brain.
Hey, Travis, blink. Blink twice. I know this is audio, but blink.
My new body never has to blink again, Chris. Terrible.
All right. Yeah. We have that going on.
Yep. You can support us on our Patreon page, patreon.com/filmcolossus. Well, you can listen to the show ad free if you're annoyed by ads. Like, you got that.
It's a beautiful thing. Ad free, the way to go.
And of course,
I don't listen to this show with ads.
No. Neither do I. And filmcolossus.com, where you can read, we talk about all the movies we mentioned that are on our weekly ranking or on our all-time rankings and 2023 rankings and everything. Like, we do write-ups about all those movies, and we have movie guides where we explain movies, and we're doing all kinds of fun shit over there.
Yeah, I'm currently doing a movie guide on Midsommar.
And I'm writing about Knock at the Cabin.
Look at us.
We're on a journey.
All right,
let's end this.
Keep it cool.
Yeah, keep it cool.